On This Week in Enterprise Tech, we talked about COVID contact tracers. Would you install it? Plus, we go through the latest developments in Apple and Google's decentralized attempt there as well. Have you thought about election security in the age of social distancing? Well, Curtis definitely has. He'll take us through all of that. Plus, remote work means more mobile devices. Does your organization use MDM? Well, John Sutcliffe is our guest. He's the head of product at Adigy, and he's going to talk about all your devices in your organization and how you can secure them. Twyatt on the set. This Week in Enterprise Tech is brought to you from LastPass Studios. Stay in control when it comes to your company's access points and authentication. LastPass makes enterprise-level security simple for your remote workforce. Check out LastPass.com/twit to learn more.
Podcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twit.
This is Twyatt, This Week in Enterprise Tech, episode 391, recorded May 1st, 2020. C19 changes MDM for BYOD. This episode of This Week in Enterprise Tech is brought to you by Wasabi Hot Cloud Storage. Thinking about moving your data storage to the cloud? Wasabi is enterprise-class cloud storage at one-fifth the price of Amazon S3 and faster than the competition, with no fees for egress or API requests and no complex storage tiers. Start a free trial at wasabi.com and enter the code ENTERPRISE. And by IT Pro TV. Dive into learning and a new IT career. Get the most up-to-date training with IT Pro TV. Visit itpro.tv/enterprise for an additional 30% off all consumer subscriptions for the lifetime of your active subscription. Use code ENTERPRISE30 at checkout. And by Worldwide Technology. Worldwide Technology has advanced technology centers like no other testing and research lab, with more than $500 million of equipment, including solutions from key partners like VMware. And it's virtual, so you can access it 24/7. To learn more and get insights into all that it has to offer, go to WET.com/twit. Welcome to Twyatt, This Week in Enterprise Check, the show that's dedicated to you, the enterprise professional, the IT pro, and that geek who just wants to know how this world is connected. I'm your host, Louis Moreski, your guide through this big, giant world of the enterprise. But I definitely can't guide you by myself. I need to bring in the professionals, the experts in their field, starting with our very own Mr. Curtis Franklin. He's the senior editor over there at Dark Reading. Curtis, so great to have you back on. How's things going down there in Florida?
Well, here in the Sunshine State, the weather is fine, and starting Monday, we get to see what life might be like as we take a tiny little baby step back towards normalcy. A lot of places are going to be opening up on a limited basis, and we'll see if we can all step back into the world while avoiding acting stupid. I'm not sure which way I'm going to bet on this one.
Either will I. Well, so are you have a little bit of a celebration you're doing today too, right?
Well, we do. My son, who is not a child by any means, is having a birthday. I'll say happy birthday, Daniel.
Happy birthday.
We'll be joining in a Zoom virtual celebration with him later on, the second in a couple of weeks. You know, it's nice to look back and remember what's gone on as a wonderful little boy became quite a magnificent young man.
Fantastic. Hopefully that will be fun. Well, speaking of experts, we have to bring back our favorite geek in paradise from the great state of Hawaii, Mr. Brian Chi. Chibert, is how's Kathy keeping you busy down there since you're home for good now?
Well, she is sewing like a mad woman. I think she's getting really close to 300 face masks that she's sewed.
Wow, that's amazing. But you're keeping busy too. You have some toys you're playing with, right?
Yeah, actually, I just helped drop a new underwater observatory cable into the water at Point Panic, which is just off Waikiki. We had to get special dispensation from all kinds of people to break the quarantine, which is weird because people are arriving by the still arriving like crazy. We had 300 people last week arriving in Honolulu, and were instantly met by the police department saying, you do realize we have a 14-day quarantine here. You know, you come in, you got to stay in your hotel room for 14 days. And they've actually been arresting people that have decided the quarantine doesn't apply to them. So this is going to be really interesting to see how the Aloha State reputation survives the shutdown.
Well, speaking of busy, we've had quite the week in enterprise news. Not only has most of the tech giants posted their earnings, we've had some interesting involvements around enterprise news. Now, you know, there's actually a lot of COVID contact tracers out there. Is this something that you would install on your device? Well, we're going to talk about the latest and greatest developments on Apple's and Google's attempt to contact tracing. Have you thought about election security, especially in this current climate? Well, Curtis is going to take us through that. Plus, remote work means more mobile devices. Do you have MDM on all your mobile devices in your organization? Well, we'll talk with John Sutcliffe, head of product at Apple device management platform Anagy, about just that. But first, it's been a busy week in the enterprise. So let's jump into this week's blips. Now, you ever wonder why more fiber ISPs haven't come to your area? Well, at first, it's to be more competitive. They were cheap, and they offered great deals at wicked fast speeds. Then came the supply and demand. And it seemed like fiber expansion came to a halt, and no more infrastructure expansion happened. Did you ever wonder why? Well, it looks like it took a bankruptcy to occur before we found out just why network expansion was put on ice. Now, although even before it announced that it would be seeking Chapter 11 bankruptcy, Frontier had well-deserved reputation for mismanagement and abusive conduct. Now, Frontier's bankruptcy announcement forced the company to explain in great detail its finances and past investment decisions. Plus, it also uncovered why Frontier refused to upgrade so many of its DSL connections to fiber at home. Now, this gives us a window into why ISPs like Frontier, large, dominant, with little to no competition, are choosing not to invest in better, faster, and more accessible internet infrastructure. Now, the reason American internet lags so far behind South Korea, Japan, and Norway isn't fiber is profitable or not. That it's actually because of the fact that most of these businesses have to follow the rule that you have to spend money to make money. Now, American ISPs have established a position of prioritizing short-term profit over making lasting investments. Now, as long as all major ISPs continue to operate with a short-term mindset, they will never deliver high-speed fiber to your home unless they're forced to do so by policymakers. Now, instead of being incentivized to grow and satisfy a customer base by investing in better service and expanding in undeserved customers, publicly traded companies' incentives are dominated by quarterly reporting. Now, this is why Verizon terminated its Fios efforts more than a decade ago. And when Verizon first started to deploy Fios and competing with cable companies such as Comcast and Charter, investment analysts criticized the company. They thought it was a waste of billions of dollars for a phone company like Verizon to consider upgrading its network to fiber. They would fall behind cable companies that would keep pace with early fiber speeds through a series of cheap incremental upgrades to coaxial lines. Now, with bankruptcy, Frontier has to obtain or entertain previously ignored long-term opportunities and efforts to restructure itself and return to business. Now, the revelations from Frontier's bankruptcy filings don't end at all of that. Equally important is how Frontier cultivated, maintained, and abused its monopolies. ISPs like Frontier know exactly where they are and that they are a monopoly, and therefore know exactly who has no choice and therefore is not worth spending money on. Now, it just means more community fibers and programs and WISPs need to add to their competitive landscape to incentivize large ISPs to start moving that needle.
Well, healthcare is being targeted by more attacks, but they're less sophisticated. Security experts said this week that healthcare organizations are experiencing an increase in probes and fraud attempts against their businesses and suppliers, but those attacks appear not to be very sophisticated. Organizations, for example, saw a 30% increase last month in the number of COVID-19-themed phishing sites and lures, but they haven't seen a similar increase in the number of successful breaches. That's according to the Healthcare Information Sharing and Analysis Center, or HISAC. Now, while some ransomware groups are avoiding attacks against healthcare firms, others are continuing their efforts with 14% of attacks in the first quarter targeting the healthcare sector. Some researchers have suggested that criminals have been reluctant to target healthcare firms because criminals are, after all, humans, and that's a good thing. But healthcare companies have long struggled with securing their networks, and the recent chaos caused by the coronavirus pandemic and managing the response at hospitals and clinics has left cybersecurity as, at best, a secondary concern. According to Palo Alto Networks, more than 80% of healthcare firms, for example, have medical imaging equipment and devices running older and unpatched operating systems.
Okay, Raspberry Pi gets a new high-quality camera upgrade. This is going to sound like a story for know-how or some sort of tinkering show, but the Raspberry Pi has made a huge impact on the enterprise world with people like NetBeeze using them for network probes. I'm using them to help monitor ultra-low temperature freezers to keep biological samples from going bad. But the idea of putting a 12.3 megapixel camera on a Pi sounds, well, frivolous. What does mean, though, is that the higher resolution camera has more pixels to work with for things like image recognition. Automate the grabbing of images off microscopes or telescopes and a multitude of other applications where a lower cost solution can expand the use of digital imagery. Since the Pi is running Linux, this also means automating the image grab is as simple as something like GPhoto or using some of the emerging open source solutions to do facial recognition. I'd also like to point out that industrial image processing systems are also available to do things like box positioning on shipping belts, barcode reading, and other image-based tasks that previously used really expensive semi-custom computers from various integration companies. Go, go, Raspberry Pi.
Now, organizations have always found that firewalls were required appliances to ensure that the security of their infrastructure. However, when you have a single point of failure like a firewall, it means that when it's down, you're down as well. Well, for people who have implemented the Sophos XG firewall, you might be battling something in a good fight here. Users of this widely used firewall from Sophos have been under a zero-day attack that was designed to steal usernames, cryptographically protected passwords, and other sensitive data. Now, the well-researched and developed attack exploited a SQL injection flaw in a fully patched version of the Sophos XG firewall. Now, once the SQL injection was executed, it downloaded and installed a series of scripts that ultimately executed code instead to make off with users' usernames, the cryptographic hash for their passwords, and the salted SHA-256 hash of the administrator account's password. Now, Sophos has delivered a hotfix that mitigates the vulnerability. Now, other data targeted by the attack included a list of IP address allocation permissions for firewall users, the version of the custom operating system running, the type of CPU, the amount of memory that was presented on the device, and how long it had been running since the last reboot, as well as the output file, the ifconfig, a command line tool, and the ARP tools and tables used to map IP addresses to device MAC addresses. Now, what it seems was the primary driver behind the malware was really just data theft by retrieving the contents of various database tables stored in the firewall, as well as by running some operating system commands. Now, as we've discussed many times here on TWiET, one of the best ways to combat the enemies is just to stay up to date.
Speaking of vulnerabilities, researchers have found some in popular remote learning plugins. Three popular WordPress plugins for online learning have significant software vulnerabilities that could allow attackers to access student information, steal money from course creators, or escalate their privileges to become teachers, according to an advisory published by security firm Checkpoint Software. Researchers from the company analyzed three popular plugins used by tens of thousands of schools, companies, and websites to provide online courses and quiz capabilities. They discovered critical issues in each platform, including SQL injection, cross-site scripting, and the unrestricted ability to upload files. The specific online learning plugins investigated by Checkpoint, LearnPress, LearnDash, and Lifter LMS are used by more than 100,000 schools, organizations, and content creators. The three platforms appear to have, for the most part, escaped attention from vulnerability researchers until now. Only a handful of CVEs have been assigned to the platform since 2018, and no published security flaws exist before that year in the National Vulnerability Database. Good news in all this? Checkpoint Software Technologies notified the creators of the plugins, and each has produced a patched version which closes the vulnerabilities on up-to-date platforms. So to echo what Lou had to say, make sure your software and all of its plugins are up to date.
According to a recently published poll, half of the Americans out there don't or won't trust contact tracing apps. We're actually going to talk a little bit more in depth about this later on in the show. But anyway, let's read this article a bit. After what feels like the longest March in April in human history, hundreds of millions of us are itching to reboot the world and get schools, retail, and every other non-essential part of society up and running again. Before we can safely do that, though, we'll need an enormous increase in our ability to perform contact tracing, identifying and contacting everybody who's been in contact with a person infected with COVID-19 so that they can in turn hunker down in quarantine and avoid infecting others. So contact tracing in a small or medium community is one thing, but doing it at scale is quite another. There are roughly 330 million people living in the United States, and reaching them all, even with a small army of trained contact tracers, is a challenge. Almost impossible, I'd say. Scale, however, is one of the things modern technology excels at. So Apple and Google have proposed a platform that would let everyone's smartphones become part of the massive national contact tracing network. I'm going to stop there because we're going to go and discuss this further in the other part of the show. But 82% of U.S. adults who have smartphones are exactly split on the issue, according to a poll released by the Washington Post and the University of Maryland. Half of the poll respondents said they would probably or definitely would use a contact tracing app, and the remaining half said they probably or definitely would not. While a majority of the respondents, 57%, expressed a reasonable amount of trust in public health agencies, less than half, 47%, said they trust health insurance firms, and only 43% said they trust tech firms such as Google or Apple. Overall, the poll indicates that only 41% of American adults have both the technological capacity and the will to use a contact tracing app. That's kind of a problem, as research suggests that digital tracing would have to reach out to about 60% of the population to be most effective. So to cap this off, one of my students, ex-students, lives in Taiwan. Yay, Josh, says the contact tracing portion is part of their national health app. So if you want access to the national health system, you have to have the app. So that kind of, you know, that's a really big carrot. So while listening to the rantings on several social media platforms, I too see an even split between about the same as those that are willing to help with face masks and those that feel it's an infringement on their freedoms. You notice how many people are going out without face masks? Yeah. I think we're going to have the same thing with contact tracing. So until someone comes up with a vaccine, face masks and contact tracing are probably going to be hot discussion topics, and we'll keep talking about that later in the show.
Well, it seems Apple might not be having such a great week. Now, their earnings were not so great, and now users might be hit with a zero-day exploit as well. Now, San Francisco-based security firm ZecOps found that attackers had used the zero-day exploit against at least six targets over the last 2 years. Well, in the now disputed report by Apple, ZecOps had said that the critical flaw was located in the Mail app and could be triggered by sending specifically manipulated emails that required no interaction on the part of users. Now, Apple pushed back on ZecOps finding here that A, the bug posed a threat to iPhone and iPad users, and B, that there had been any active exploit at all. Now, lots of other firms have come forward here, the research firms, and they have also stepped up to question ZecOps as well. Now, the disputed findings were based on evidence that the malicious emails were deleted, presumably to hide the attacks, but the data then remained in logs, indicating the deletions and crashes were the result of an exploit. Now, the critics said if the exploit was able to delete the emails, it would have been able to delete the crash logs and other data as well. Now, the critics feel that that might be an oversight, and some other technical details contained in the ZecOps report strongly suggested the flaw was more of a benign bug that was triggered by certain types of email. Now, also skeptical, the critics said, is that had they had advanced exploit would have caused a crash at all. Now, those doubts have continued ever since. However, Zach Cops noted that based on the data collected on iPhones in Belize that they were exploited, and the company researchers were able to write a proof of concept exploit that took full control of a fully updated device. Now, in the meantime, if this exploit is real, that means all devices are vulnerable unless you have used Apple's release patch for the beta version of the upcoming 13.4.5. Now, in the meantime, you might just have to wonder if your device is really safe at all. Well, folks, that does it for the blips. Next up, the bites. But before we get to the bites, we have to thank a really great sponsor of This Week in Enterprise Tech. And that's Wasabi. Now, you're already storing data. It could be on-prem or already in the cloud. Well, think about this. Wasabi is 80% cheaper than Amazon S3 and significantly cheaper than on-premise storage. Typically, you can store data in Wasabi's cloud for less than just the annual cost of the maintenance fees on the same amount of on-premise storage. Wasabi's disruptive price-performance model makes buying cloud storage a natural addition. Now, in fact, if you've managed a service provider, Wasabi is a perfect solution for you to sell because you can earn more while charging less. Now, there are two ways to pay. You can pay as you go, or you can pay one time with reserved capacity storage. Now, Wasabi's reserved capacity storage actually makes buying cloud storage a natural addition to your on-prem storage. Now, if you're thinking about buying more hardware storage, compare the price against 5 years of reserved capacity storage. You can purchase cloud storage in 1, 3, or 5 year increments and achieve greater discounts for term and capacity. Now, Wasabi's security is often even greater than on-premise storage. They provide 11 nines of durability. Then this means the average you'll lose one file every 649,000 years. So basically never lose a file. Now, hosted in premier tier 4 data center facilities that are highly secure, fully redundant, Wasabi is secure by default. And all data stored in Wasabi Cloud is also encrypted at rest, even if the requested party doesn't specify encryption. Now, Wasabi follows industry best security models and design practices. Access control mechanisms such as bucket policies and access control lists can be used to selectively grant those permissions, and your data will be immutable. That means preventing data from being erased or altered, and you'll be protected from hackers, malware, and even, that's right, even yourself. Now, Wasabi has active integrity checking where all objects are stored and checked for integrity every 90 days. And if you're worried about compliance, well, they are HIPAA, FINRA, and CGIS compliant as well. Wasabi is not just highly secure, disruptive technology that's turning the industry on its ear. It's storage that's 80% cheaper and up to 6 times faster than the speed of the industry leader. Calculate the savings for yourself and start a free trial of storage for a month. Go to wasabi.com, click the free trial link, and enter the code Enterprise. Join the movement and migrate your data to the cloud with confidence. Go to wasabi.com and make sure to use the offer code Enterprise. And we thank Wasabi for their support of This Week in Enterprise Tech. Well, folks, it's now time for the bites. Now, as Brian alluded to in his blip, and we've talked about contact tracing before and its attempt to basically provide security alerting for when you come in contact with COVID-19 infected individuals. Now, Apple and Google have been working on a system together that essentially handshakes devices between devices, exchanging random tokens that are then back-end would actually track a case of whether you had contact with that individual that had COVID or not. Now, people were still worried about the technology and how it could still be exploited and not be made private anymore. Now, Apple and Google have provided a number of updates about the technical details of their contact tracing system, which they are now exclusively referring to as an exposure notification technology. That's right. They've renamed it. Now, since the companies say that this is a better way to actually describe what they are going to be offering. Now, changes include modifications made to their APIs, as well as that company also provides stronger privacy protections for individual users and changes to how the API works that they claim will enable health authorities building apps that make use of it to develop more effective software. Now, the additional measures being implemented to protect privacy include changing the cryptographic mechanism for generating the keys used to trace potential contacts. They are no longer specifically bound to a 24-hour period, and they're now randomly generated instead of derived from a so-called tracing key that was permanently attached to the device. Now, in theory, with the old system, an advanced enough attack with direct access to the device could potentially be used to figure out how individual rotating keys were generated from the tracing key, though that would be very, very difficult to do. Apple and Google clarified that it was also including for the sake of efficiency originally, but they later realized they didn't actually need to do this to ensure the system worked as intended, so they eliminated it altogether. Now, there are some additional improvements here, but the interesting thing is they're moving forward. They're advancing the technology. They're evolving the software and the systems. So I want to bring my co-host in because a very, very interesting set of topics here. Cheebert, I want to throw this to you. We obviously see an evolution of the system. Why should anybody trust the system, even though they're continually evolving it?
Well, the issue is it's not storing any kind of PII. It's storing a randomly generated identifier. So the idea is it just stores this. It will detect other of these IDs. And if and only if there is a person that's deemed infected, healthcare professionals have to trigger it. They will go in and say, okay, this is this person's unique identifier that was randomly generated on their device. Have they been in contact with someone? Now, the really, really, really nice thing about this, and this is, I put this in the same category as wearing a mask. You're not doing this so much for yourself, but for your community. So if someone is infected, it goes and finds all the other addresses and it kind of sends out a query saying, hey, if this is your unique identifier, it should pop up a message saying, please go and see your healthcare providers. I really, really, really like this idea. You know, I know everybody's, you know, making a lot of noise about, oh, we're giving up our freedoms and so forth. But I'm actually giving up less freedoms than even my student in Taiwan, because that one actually is tied to a person so that their healthcare people actually know who the person is. In this case, they really don't. They only know the number of the person and goes and does that. And it's one of those things where if the chef in the food truck that I just bought, you know, bought food from 3 days ago. I have no idea who this is, but oh my God, he got infected. I really, really want to know that. I want to know about it sooner than later. So I'm going to throw out a vote. I vote this is a really good thing. I'm going to install it as soon as it's available onto my platform and my wife's platform. What do you guys say?
I think it's a good point. The interesting thing here, Cheebert, you brought up a good point before about some governments are actually implementing it using something custom. And it brings up a key outstanding question, is that what will happen in the case governments that actually choose really using centralized protocols for COVID-19 contact tracing apps with proximity data uploaded to a central data server, which could be exploited, rather than opting for a decentralized approach, which is what Apple and Google are trying to do in their supported APIs. So, Curtis, I want to throw this to you. You know, with this kind of different way that each organization, maybe each government is implementing it, is this a means for users to just not trust it altogether?
Well, I think that there is a big trust differential between the centralized and the decentralized methods. But you have to admit that there is also a difference in what privacy means and the expectations of what government is going to be able to do with individual data in those nations where centralized approaches are being considered versus here in the U.S. where it's a decentralized. Now, to my way of thinking, you asked the question, are we trading off privacy for the capability to trace contacts in a pandemic? Absolutely, yes. The question is really one of a calculus. You know, how much privacy are we giving up versus how much utility could the contact tracing offer? And that's something that a lot of people are going to have to figure out. And let's be honest, this is like a lot of things. I would say this is a basic network valuation proposition where it becomes more valuable exponentially as more people within the population opt in. If 100% of the population has opted into this, then it's amazingly useful. But here in the U.S., we also know that if the capability exists to at any point extrapolate back from one-time keys to individual devices, not even in individual human beings, but individual devices, it will be a very short time before some law enforcement agency is in there with a search warrant or a subpoena demanding that they reverse identify, do the identification for a criminal and who they have been in contact with. Now, there will be some who say, if you're not a criminal, you shouldn't have anything to worry about. Others take a more restrictive view of that sort of thing. Do I think it's worth it? I think in the vast majority of cases, it would be. In something like our current pandemic, it would have been exceptionally valuable. There are other things, even more localized, where we've talked about things like hepatitis outbreaks, even encephalitis and some other things, where it would be useful to have this contact tracing. The real question is how much intrusion into our digital lives enough of the population is willing to consider in order to make this truly valuable. And that's something that neither I nor the folks at Apple and Google know quite yet.
I'm gonna play devil's advocate here for a second, because I'm just not a believer that unless a good majority of the population start using this, that it will be that useful. Cheaper, what do you think? Is this something that like 100% of the populations need to be used to basically be useful here?
No. The public health people are saying 60%. I equate this to kind of like that Waze app, W-A-Z-E. I use it in Honolulu, and when I start up, it says, oh, there's 600-something Wazers around you. But if I do the same thing and say Sunnyvale, it'll say, oh, there are 10,000. Well, Waze is a lot more useful for me in Sunnyvale, but it's still useful for me in Honolulu. So my opinion is that we need to do something, even if half the population says no way. I still say being able to find infected people faster, even if it's I can only really detect it in half the population, at least that's half the population that I am going to worry about less. It's one of those things. I like the idea. I don't like the potential for abuse, but I really like the design in that even if Apple and Google both agree and they both say, yes, we're going to cooperate with law enforcement, they can't do jack because they can't even get into it. Now, unfortunately, there's a lot more details that I would love to talk about, but I'm on a gag order. But I have faith in this particular technology, and I think it actually provides a lot more privacy than the apps that people are using in other countries. And I think it's a good compromise.
Right. Well, we'll have to definitely see how it evolves over time for sure. Well, I do want to jump into the next bite for Curtis is going to go through here. And so I want to ask, Curtis, how is election security evolving in the age of social distancing?
It's forgivable if it slipped the national mind during the coronavirus pandemic, but a national election is still scheduled for Tuesday, November 3rd, 2020. And there are, fortunately, still people who are focusing their attention on making sure that the election process is secure, even if those people aren't entirely confident that secure and election go together like peanut butter and chocolate. Now, I don't think that an outsider can tell you whether you're going to have a secure election. In some areas, it could happen by mail. Some are going to use voting machines, and some use a combination of these, and as well as others. And all of those mean that we're talking about many different elections rather than one election. The problem really is in our ability to audit the systems, not just electronic, but all the way down to paper systems, to make sure that they are completely trustworthy. The key is doing this in a way that reassures the voters that what they are having is a secure and reliable election, while doing as little as possible to get in the way of them casting their ballot. So one of the things that many of the experts are worried about is what they call the different layers of elections, because not only are we having a presidential election, but we're going to be electing a third of the Senate, all of the House of Representatives, plus countless state and local officials. And to many ways of thinking about it, each one of those layers is a separate election. Each one has different motives, although generally affecting the way that policy is made is the goal. Each of those different layers of government affect that decision differently. Not only that, but there are multiple ways that an adversary could have an impact on the democratic process. Now, a lot of people tend to focus on the question of whether the votes will be cast, registered as they are cast, and then properly counted as they're registered. But as we saw in the last election, there are a lot of ways where an outsider can try to have an impact, whether it's through social media, stories planted in the regular media, or even other means. There are lots of layers at which they can have an impact. There are organizations, companies like Cyber Reason, who go in and do what is effectively wargaming of election scenarios. And they did one back in February where they looked at a number of these different layers. They took a look at what would happen if adversaries tried to use social media, plant stories in the mainstream media, or even manipulate the traffic signals to try and keep voters away from the polls. Broadly speaking, what they found was that it's quite easy for an outside actor to strew chaos and come back and make things difficult for a while, but that officials do have it within their capability to go back and correct for that in a sufficiently timely manner to keep the chaos from having an impact on the results. So there are a number of things here that we're going to be looking at. And one of them, I'm going to start, Brian, with you. People do become fixated on this endpoint security. That's the security of the voting mechanism, when a lot of experts say that it's the back-end systems, the database servers where voter rolls are kept, or even the email systems used by the secretaries of state, that are the real points of vulnerability. Do you see any analog with that and enterprise security, where people get very fixated on what's happening on the laptop and sometimes take their eye off what's going on back in the servers?
It's always that case. It's what they can see that they tend to worry about. So as a result, I personally think it's the low-hanging fruit is going to be those servers, because then you can have the biggest bang for the buck. So if you're going to have someone, let's go worst-case scenario, say a nation state wants to mess with our presidential election. They're not going to spend all the human resources to go and mess with the voting systems unless they can do it all across the board, say, with a bug. They're going to go after the databases because that's going to be the low-hanging fruit. And that's the same thing. You don't go after really the ATM machines. You go after the banking systems that are on the back end of those ATMs. I think it's going to be the back-end databases and management systems that people are going to go for.
Well, I think you're right. And I've spoken to a number of experts who make that point. Lou, I want to look to you for another question about layers of a different sort. You know, the war game looked at a number of things like external infrastructure, traffic flow, things like social media and the impact that can have on the way people think and act on information. Do you think that issues like that should be part of an enterprise security plan as much as, say, issues of keeping malware off local systems?
Absolutely. I think that, you know, especially ensuring you're educating your users, you're bringing them campaigns to bring them through kind of mock campaigns to basically bring them through this whole situation. We're seeing if they believe the information they see, whether it's email or, you know, posts by users, social streams, you know, documents, that kind of thing, to make sure that they understand that there is going to be data out there that should be fact checked and, you know, that they don't believe anything that they basically get when it comes to emails and other kind of devices when it comes to this type of thing. And I think that should definitely be part of it. I think we actually see a lot of organizations, they implement these campaigns where, you know, they have people report specific potential malware and or spam in their email, and they see how many people actually do this reporting or how many people actually catch it, as well as how many people click on the links or even copy the data. And it's interesting. It's actually kind of crazy to see how many users actually fall for this type of thing. And so by bringing this education to your users, just making sure you provide simple guidelines for doing this, as well as services and systems to help them along the way, I definitely think enterprises will be in a better space and a better place in the long term.
Very, very good. Well, this is one that we're going to be visiting again, I'm sure, between now and November. But I think it's important not only to think about it from the position of the elections, but in seeing how many lessons are being learned through election security that we can apply back to the enterprise. Speaking of back, it's time for me to throw it back to Lou. I know we've got at least one ad and, more important, an outstanding guest to get to before we call it a wrap on this episode of TWiET.
That's right. Next up, we get to bring a guest in to drop some knowledge on the TWiET Riot. But before we do, we have to thank another great sponsor of This Week in Enterprise Tech, and that's IT Pro TV. Now, you are a busy professional. I'm a busy professional. It can be difficult to learn new skills or develop skills to make a career change, right? Well, IT Pro TV has made learning IT and finishing IT certifications simple. Not only will you be able to learn quickly, but you can learn at your own pace when you have time. Now, there's plenty of uncertainty in the world right now, but IT Pro TV will help teach you skills to become an IT professional, a career that's nearly recession-proof. Now, itpro.tv/enterprise can help you sign up for remote learning opportunities that they actually offer to you. Now, IT Pro TV helps you learn the skills to become a developer, a network admin, a sysadmin, and many other possible roles. The sky is really the limit here. Now, IT Pro TV always has the most up-to-date content. This is vital with a constantly changing IT world. Now, they will always have content that's current, relevant, and up-to-date. Now, are you the head of a team or looking to develop your team skills? Well, IT Pro TV offers corporate standard, corporate premium, and corporate enterprise plans to fit your business size. There are over 4,000 hours of IT training that they can offer, as well as being the official video training partner for CompTIA, and have 12 CompTIA on-demand courses, including CompTIA A+, Network Plus, and Security Plus certifications. If you are about to cancel your next conference, don't. IT Pro TV will deliver and facilitate your next virtual conference. They will take your conference online with general sessions and breakout sessions, and they can do it with speakers live in studio or remotely. Get the skills you need to be an IT professional or set your team up for success. Go to itpro.tv/enterprise and use the code ENTERPRISE30 to receive 30% off all consumer subscriptions. That's itpro.tv/enterprise and use the code ENTERPRISE30 for an additional 30% off for the lifetime of your active subscription. IT Pro TV, build or expand your IT career and enjoy that journey. And we thank IT Pro TV for their support of This Week in Enterprise Tech. Well, folks, it's now my favorite part of the show where we get to bring in a guest to drop some knowledge on the Twilight Riot. Today we have John Sutcliffe, head of product at the Apple device management platform Adigee. John, welcome. Welcome to the show.
Oh, thanks for having me. It's good to be here.
Absolutely. We're really going to enjoy this show because MDM is one of those great topics, especially in this today's climate. But before we get to that, our audience loves to hear people's journey through technology. Can you maybe take us through your journey and how you ended up at Adigee?
Sure. I've been in this world for a long time now. It seems like I'm an old guy now. I think most of my kids are grown and out of the house. But I started out in COBOL. And who knew that I would be so popular again today? But, you know, I got a degree in computer science, started writing COBOL on mainframes and big organizations. When the internet came along, got moved over working on the early days of the Microsoft technology, IIS 1.0, and all those fun things. And kind of came along in the internet world doing Microsoft work. Around 2000, I joined my first startup here in the Twin Cities. Had success there. That was actually a financial company where we were doing work again for big enterprises who were doing sophisticated planning for their financial planning. We were still at that point in time putting machines on-prem. We didn't really call it on-prem then, but everybody had their own IT team and all those things. That eventually ended up where I was inside of IBM for a number of years. And I'm a person who really enjoys a smaller, fast-moving company, the startup world. So around 2010, 2011, I joined Jamf, who's in the same space. I was there for a long time. They got pretty big. And a year ago, I discovered Adigee. In the same space, Apple admins are a wonderful community, and I'd been working at another startup in a different space, but the Apple community, the administrators and whatnot really care about the products you build for them. They're great users. They don't hesitate with the feedback. Sometimes it's not always a great feedback, but what you want to hear, but that's good. It helps us build better products. So having the opportunity to come back into this brought me over to Adigee.
Fantastic. Now, you've had quite the ride, but bear with me for a second. Can you maybe tell me a little bit more about why you switched maybe from engineering over to product roles?
At Adigee, we have an amazing leader of the engineering team. And really, in my role, especially in the last 10 years, 10 or 15 years, the way I've always worked with engineering, leading on the engineering side, but working very tightly with product management, we're always really joined at the hip. And so there's always a lot of back and forth, working very closely with the product team. And I seem to also have the skill of being able to be that person who can carry the papers between the people and communicate with both teams. So when I started to talk to Jason Detmar, the founder at Adigee, had super strong leadership in the engineering team, but he was really looking to beef up on the product side. And he's like, well, are you interested in trying product? And it's like, yeah, let's give this a go. And again, I've always been a big believer in engineering being very connected to the customer as well. I think it's very important to have engineers talk to end users. It shouldn't always just be a product team or product marketing or whatever talking to them. So I've always spent a lot of time with customers anyway, which kind of makes this a pretty natural fit. There is a learning curve. Some things are very different, but it's been a really interesting challenge.
Now, our audience is kind of IT pro and enterprise heavy individuals, but a lot of them are kind of evolving their systems over time. And we know that MDM itself is evolving over time, but I'm just curious, maybe you can give us a quick overview of what MDM is to you and how it's kind of evolved.
Sure. When MDM first came out, it was only for mobile devices. Apple shipped it on the iOS platform. And again, it was at the request of enterprises. People were coming in with these smartphones. They wanted to get their corporate email. They wanted to get access to files, all those sorts of things. And there was really no good way of managing it. That's where MDM came into play. So mobile device management, which is a little bit of a misnomer today because after several years, Apple moved it into the Macintosh world as well. Before that, all the work to manage Macintoshes had been put an agent on the machine. That agent has full access to thing, running as root. You can do those sorts of things. So what MDM has done is bring that additional capability now across the whole enterprise. You can manage your iOS devices, your TVs, and your Macs, no matter what you need to do. You want to enforce password criteria, set it up once, and you're going to deploy it to your iOS devices. You're going to deploy it to your Macs as well, those kinds of things. So MDM has really enabled a lot of additional capabilities, whether it's when devices arrive, ensuring they get into the right people's hands, simplifying if I've bought licenses for a particular product, how can I get that pushed out to different people? MDM has become very critical, especially just in the last 2 years. Apple, it's interesting, all the talk about privacy. And one of the things that Apple prides themselves on is privacy of that end user, protecting that data on the machine. They put that first and foremost. And without MDM on a machine, it becomes very difficult now for an administrator to be able to really take care of that machine in a way to make that employee successful.
What have organizations been doing? I know some organizations obviously don't have MDM yet. Maybe they do, and they haven't like really gone in and look at the policies they've had. What are you seeing that organizations are doing for that whole bring your own device kind of nomenclature for their organizations when they either don't have MDM or they just haven't been using it that well? What are they doing instead?
Well, first of all, if you've got iOS, iOS devices, if people are bringing in phones, you're going to have to use MDM. There's no other approach. But again, the BYOD is a really interesting case too, because at the same time, while people want to have their mobile phone be able to get to their email or, you know, Slack or whatever the case may be, they're also very nervous about the fact that my employer may have access to my device. Maybe my device gets wiped for whatever reason. I lose my photos and things like that. MDM, what it really allows now is the ability to essentially cordon off a part of your device. In a BYOD situation, if I show up with my iPhone, I can enroll it with BYOD, and essentially then that only gives my company just a slice of my device where they can put my email, maybe those files, and that's all they're going to wipe if they want to take that off there, those kinds of things. So again, BYOD is fantastic for that. You know, the other thing too is little things. Well, it's not little, it's expensive for a company. How many machines have I got out there? Even more importantly, if now, especially with the pandemic, I need to order a new laptop for an employee, right? And so I'm going to drop ship it right from Apple, right to the individual's house. It shows up. They open that machine. I want to make sure that the person who is opening it and is starting that machine is my employee. My employee has access to that machine. And again, with MDM, we're able to do that. And a lot of companies are just discovering those sorts of capabilities. Like, and schools have been actually doing this for quite some time. Apple perfected a lot of these technologies in the school, trying to get devices in the hands of 1,000 kids on back to school night. And these same technologies that have come with MDM really make it secure now when you get that endpoint. To me at home, my IT team knows John's got that device. That machine is enrolled. I can get the software he needs on it, and we can proceed.
When we come back, we do want to talk a little bit more with John about MDM and how kind of this evolution has happened, especially in the last 6 months. But before we get to all that, we do have to thank another great sponsor of This Week in Enterprise Tech, and that is Worldwide Technology. Now, if you've ever had to get a chance to visit the Worldwide Technology Advanced Technology Center, you should definitely go. It's a truly amazing site that began building it almost 10 years ago, and it's grown exponentially. It really is like no other testing and research lab you have ever seen. Now, listen to what the lab actually contains. More than $500 million in equipment from hundreds of OEMs and key partners ranging from high-tech heavyweights like VMware, Dell EMC, and Microsoft to emerging disruptors like Equinix. Now, when you're developing products, you want to work with an organization you can trust, especially in the long term, don't you? Well, WWT is that trusted partner who will stay with you over the years. In fact, many of their customers have been with them for over a decade because they know WWT is where they can go to get the answers they need to make sure their businesses run right. Now, their ATC is an incubator for IT innovation. Now, on-demand and schedule labs like VMware Cloud or on AWS, along with hundreds of other labs representing the newest advances in network and virtualization, software-defined data center, security, digital workspace, multi-cloud architecture, and automation, and much, much more. Now, you can also learn about products before you launch. WWT's engineers use these environments to quickly spin up proof of concepts and pilots using the sandboxes so customers can confidently select the best solutions. Now, in many cases, this actually reduces concept time from months to weeks, which increases speed to market. Now, they offer lab as a service as a dedicated lab space within the ATC. Here, customers can perform programmatic testing using the vast technology system that WWT has already built. And it's virtual, so you can take full advantage of the ATC's unique benefits anywhere in the world 24/7. Now, WWT's engineers work in these labs every day. They beta test new solutions based on the latest and greatest VMware technologies and building reference architectures and custom integrations to help their customers make decisions and see results faster with much less investment. WWT has launched their new digital platform encompassing the ATC ecosystem. Now, this ecosystem creates a multiplier effect of knowledge, speed, and agility anytime, anywhere around the world for their customers. Get access to articles, case studies, hands-on labs, and other tools that make the difference in today's fast-paced world. To learn more about the WWT, the ATC, and become a member of their growing community, go to WWT.com/twit to create an account and gain access to their on-demand labs today. WWT simplifies the complex. That's WWT.com/twit. WWT, delivering business and technology outcomes around the world. And we thank Worldwide Technology for their support of This Week in Enterprise Tech. Well, folks, we've been talking with John Sutcliffe. He's the head of the product Apple device manager platform over there at Adigy. And we've been talking a little bit about MDM. We haven't got really too far into it yet, but I want to kind of, John, I want to kind of throw it over to you again and talk a little bit about how you talk to say the last 2 years, things have changed quite a bit. But what about even just in the last 6 months? What are you seeing requirements change in the landscape in the last 6 months when it comes to MDM?
Yeah, the last 6 months, things have really been moving. You know, again, it comes back to Apple and privacy. Apple's been doubling down on ensuring the privacy of their end users. And what that means, too, is they're doubling down on in their latest operating systems with 10.15, where they're doing a lot more to ensure, A, an application that's installed on a machine is from who it says it's from. And they're also doing a lot more for the end user to be able to control the permissions that application has before it'll execute. Things along the lines of, can it access a file? Can it get to my camera? Can it get to my microphone? What that means is IT administrators, when you get that new device and we've got all this software, we need to get down there for you to do your job and be effective. If those settings aren't right, when that software arrives and you start to get prompted over and over with this dialogue that's asking you, can it do this? And this dialogue, can you do that? Then you run into the problem, what you guys were talking about before too, where people click on links. You almost get link fatigue, right? Or dialogue box fatigue. You're like, yeah, I'll do this. Yes. I just want to do my job, right? So again, with those changes, locking down the privacy, IT administrators with MDM are able to get those settings into the right state. So when that software arrives, the user is not going to just get flooded with, do I have permission to do this? Do I have permission to do that? And again, a lot of this is with the trust in the organization you're working for as well. They've provided you with a device. And you know, they've laid out expectations for what that device is for, and you trust them to be able to help you. And you know, what becomes so important, again, what you guys were talking earlier was security and happy users. If your users are happy, especially happy with IT, they're going to listen to IT when we reach out and try to train them around things as well. If they're frustrated with the experience with their laptop, whatever it is, and they've got a, you know, they're, oh, IT is telling me to do this and IT is telling me to do that, they're not going to listen to you when you try to educate them around, here's why you should be skeptical of emails that arrive from someone you don't know, or double check that the email is really from who it says. So again, with our tools and with the continuing locking down of devices, with MDM, we give the administrator more control to be able to get that machine in a state that the user is going to be able to use it successfully right out of the box and hopefully be happy.
Right. Well, that's the hard part, right? Getting your users to always be happy. I want to throw over to Curtis first, because Curtis, you wanted to kind of go through a little bit about some of the different users that are kind of in this kind of environment, right?
Well, absolutely. And you know, you were answering actually a number of the questions I had in your last response, and I appreciate that. But I'm curious, you know, as you are talking to your customers, as you're hearing about companies, are there significant differences in what different employees will put up with depending upon whether BYOD is an option or it's a requirement, and depending upon how they've been prepared for the introduction of MDM by the organization?
Absolutely. It's you've got a span of users, right? You've got the folks who they come in and they've been taught what they do on their machine, and that's what they're going to do all day. They don't want to think about their computer. It's just a tool, as the same as if it were a hammer. I'm going to pound nails with it. I don't want to think about it. I know I need to do these things on it and go at it. And then when all the way to, you know, we have customers who are software companies. So you've got IT administrators trying to manage a machine that has a software engineer who's used to going in and having root access because they're building software that's going to have some interaction with the operating system or something like that. So we've got this whole span of people, and some companies, they have that span of people in the same organization. So you have to take different approaches. You know, how much can you trust the person to take care of their own machine? Then you've got different industries. For instance, government is a really interesting one, because everything that happens on a government-owned machine is in the public record. So you can imagine if when you file the paperwork, I want all the reports about some particular event, anybody who's engaged in that, they may have to go audit their machines and pull data off it. So that user, their expectation is, oh man, this is a government machine. Whatever I do on here, I'm not going to email my partner that we need milk, because that's essentially in the public record. Then you've got the software developers, like, oh, IT is killing me. I need root access because I got to open this port and do this thing. I can't test my software. They're killing me. You know, to the other person who's like, I can't log into my machine. What do I do? And they've just got friction in front of them. So it's you've just got an amazing audience of people that we have to deal with. And one of the things I struggle with too is, again, we're a software company. Everybody we work with in our office, right, are high tech people, and it's very easy to get blinded by, oh yeah, well, this is easy, right? Because this is what we do for a living, and be able to step back. And at the end of the day, what we're trying to do for our admins is make sure that they can get the best experience in front of that whole audience of people that they're trying to help. So,
makes sense. Well, I do want to kind of throw it over to Brian next, because Brian, you had some questions for John here.
Well, my questions are just, you know, what kinds of best practices and what kinds of inventory or preparation should someone do before they start even thinking about contacting anyone about an MDM solution?
Well, the first step is going to be trying to figure out what do we have for devices, which I was just talking to a friend of mine last night, having a beer about and standing 8 feet away from each other. And he was talking about the challenge they've had where all of a sudden everybody just went home to work. They're not an organization that was remote at all. And they're trying to figure out, well, they don't even know how many machines they do have. So, step one is finding out what do we have, you know, and step two is taking a look at, what do you want to achieve? And like any project, kind of laying down, you know, what are our goals, but really make it in small steps as well. Make it a real iterative approach. The biggest thing is to take a look at what are your pain points? How do your IT admins behave today to be able to take care of people? What do they do when someone has a problem? How are they notified of that problem? What actions do they take to be able to do it? What actions do you want to be able to use this tool, this mobile device management, whatever else, to be able to solve? How can that tool leverage, or how can that tool leverage, be leveraged to be able to simplify some of the work they have to do? For instance, if somebody walks to the help desk to get help all the time and the IT person turns that laptop around and they look at it and then they log in, are you looking to replace that experience? Be able to do it virtually where they can stay in their office, call IT, and IT can get on that machine from wherever they're at, you know? And now, especially in the times we're in right now, that's even more important because that device is at Bill's house and you can't drive over to Bill's house to be able to help him out. So, you know, it's what are we trying to achieve? What can we make simpler? What is the experience that we want our end users to have? Because at the end of the day, the goal is about those end users on those machines being able to get their job done. It's not about being really great at Adagy, although that helps.
That's right. It's kind of getting out of the way of the users. I really like that. It's a good kind of segue because we are running a little low on time. I do want to maybe give you the chance to maybe tell organizations or users where they can go to get more about Adagy and how they can get in touch with your company and get started.
Sure. Thank you. Again, you can visit adagy.com, ADDIGY.com. There it is. You can get a 14-day free trial of our product. You can, within 5 minutes, you can hit our sign-up site and have a device enrolled, a Mac, an iOS device, a TV, and be able to start to experiment with the product, be able what you can do. Again, we've got help right there. Again, my email is john@adagy.com. I'm easy to reach. I love talking to people and hearing what problems they're having and the problems they're trying to solve. Sign up for the trial, check out the website, and we're happy to talk to you.
Sounds great. Well, folks, you've done it again. You sat through another hour of the Best Thing Enterprise podcast in the universe, and you stop resisting the urge to play us during your virtual social hours. I want to thank everyone who makes this show possible, especially to my co-host, starting with Mr. Brian Chi Chiebert. What's going on for you in this coming week, and where can people find you?
I am Chiebert at twit.tv, or on Twitter, I am ADVNETLAB, Advanced Net Lab. Okay, Chiebert is spelled Cheebert. My students had a Dilbert naming convention in the lab, and of course, they decided I had to be Chiebert. Thank you, Mike Cannata. Anyway, better yet, why don't you email twit@twit.tv, and we'd love to hear show ideas and comments. I have fairly thick skin. Some of you don't like what we're doing. Some of you do. It's all good, you know, such is life. Anyway, I am still getting used to the concept of being retired. I am starting to wake up a little later, which is kind of cool. I am still working on undersea observatories just because they're shorthanded and They don't have any IT people, even though I gave them 2 years warning so I could cross train someone. But such is life. Anyway, thank you one and all. And it's been a lot of fun. John, thank you so much for being a great guest.
Thanks, Cheever. Well, we also have to thank Mr. Brian. Sorry, not Mr. Brian. We also have to thank Mr. Curtis Franklin, senior editor over there at Dark Reading. Curtis, what's going on in the coming week for you, and where can people find you and all your work?
Well, you know, the bad guys have been really good to us at Dark Reading because they haven't slacked off during the pandemic. We still have plenty to write about in the world of cybersecurity, and do have some stuff like the election security piece that we talked about today on the show. I've got another one that just went up about a researcher who followed the birth of a bit of malware. And it's kind of interesting to hear them talk about following this malware, seeing the versions that come out sort of pre-release and what it's likely to become. All of my stuff is available at Dark Reading, both at the main site and over at the edge of Dark Reading, where I get to do a little bit longer and, well, a little bit more off the beaten path stuff. So let me know. And in general, you'll find out about all of that at my Twitter feed, KG4GWA, or even on my Instagram, Kurt Franklin. Follow me either. Let me know what you'd like to see. Look forward to being back here on TWiET real soon now.
Thanks, Curtis. Well, thank you guys for being here. It definitely wouldn't be TWiET without you. Well, folks, we also have to thank you as well. You are the person who drops in each and every week to watch and to listen to our show to get your enterprise goodness. We want to make it easy for you to watch and to listen to catch up on your enterprise news. Go to our show page right now, twit.tv/TWiET. There you will find all the amazing back episodes, the show notes, the co-host information, guest information, and the links we do for the stories that we do during the show. But more importantly, next to those videos, you'll get those helpful and subscribe and download links, of course. Support the show by getting your audio version, your video version, or your HD video version of your choice and listen on any one of your devices or on any one of your podcast applications. We're on all of them. Now, it's the best way to stay on top of your enterprise and IT news. And after you subscribe, you can impress your friends with the gift of TWiET, your family members, your coworkers, because you know what? They need to stay on top of their enterprise tech technology news as well. Now, if you're already subscribed, you can also maybe check out the show if you can live every Friday, 1:30 p.m. Pacific time here on Fridays. We do the show live at live.twit.tv. There you can see how the show is run. Come see all the behind the scenes, the banter, all the fun we have at live.twit.tv. Plus, if you're going to watch the show live, you must jump in into the chat room live as well. We have a great chat room. We have a great set of characters there that give us a lot of topics and questions during the show. We really love doing that and getting jumping in there and interacting with them. That's at irc.twit.tv. You can jump in there at any time during the live broadcast, and we can definitely take some questions from you. Now, if you can't watch show live, but you still want to be part of the amazing community, you still want to ask questions and join the discussions, well, come join the 24/7 discussion on our new community website at twit.community. All the hosts are out there. The TWiET community has some great actually discussions on content and just about the technology, the shows, everything. So go check that out. If you just can't do it live, well, go jump into that 24/7 discussion at twit.community. Remember, you can always follow me at twitter.com/LouMM. There I actually post all my enterprise tidbits. Plus, of course, I have really great conversations with people like you. Plus, you can also see what I do during my normal work week at Microsoft. And if you want to check it out, go to office.com. Check out all the development ways to make your office more productive by customizing it for your organization. Also, remember, Microsoft Build's coming up. That's May 19th to the 21st. Be ready to check out all of that information, all that streams, because guess what? It's free. It's online. So check that out. Also, want to thank everyone who makes this show possible, especially to Leah and Lucy. They continue to support us each and every week to do This Week in Enterprise Tech, and we just couldn't do the show without them. So thank you to Leah and Lisa for their continuing support. Also, we want to thank all the engineers at TWiET. Of course, we want to thank Mr. Brian Chee one more time. He's not only our co-host, but Cheever is our tireless producer as well. He does all the bookings and the plannings for the show, and we just really couldn't do the show without him. So thanks again, Cheever, for all your support. Now, before we sign out, we also have to thank our TD for today, Jeff. Jeff, are you still the lone man in the studio there?
I am. When I'm here, I'm the only one here wearing a mask.
Well, Well, you know what? I wanted to ask you, because obviously during this time, a lot of people are listening to music or watching movies. What have you been listening to? What have you been watching?
You know, I have an amazing studio at my house, so I'm working on a lot of music as well as video. And, you know, I take a break every now and then and watch a movie. But I like working in my studio. It's my craft, and I love producing music and editing videos. But I do want to thank all those hard workers out there that have been the victims of having to stay at work, the people at the grocery stores, and also the delivery drivers that have been, you know, coming to the house and still delivering stuff on time and out there doing all that. And I just want to say thanks to all those people out there. It really makes our life a little easier, and we know you're working hard.
Thanks, Chef. Great way to end the show. We definitely want to say thanks to all of you. Well, until next time, I'm Louis Maresca, just reminding you, if you want to know what's going on in the Enterprise, just keep quiet.